Blog Talk Radio.
I'm going to start to show up a little different today, try to explain what's going on with my eye right now. Optic neuritis is an inflammation of the optic nerve, the bundle of nerve fibers that transmit visual information from your eye to your brain. Pain and temporary vision loss are common symptoms of optic neuritis. Optic neuritis is highly associated with multiple sclerosis, a disease that causes inflammation and damage to the nerves in the brain and spinal cord. In some people, signs and symptoms of optic neuritis may be the first indication of multiple sclerosis. Most people have a single episode of optic neuritis, eventually recover their vision. Treatment with steroid medications may speed up recovery after optic neuritis. Symptoms. Pain. Most people who develop optic neuritis experience eye pain that's worsened with eye movement. Sometimes pain feels like a dull ache behind the eye. Vision loss. People experience at least some temporary reduction in vision, but the extent of vision loss varies. Noticeable vision loss develops over hours or days. Exercise or hot bath or shower may exaggerate the vision loss. Vision loss is permanent in some cases. Loss of color vision affects the color perception. You might notice colors appear less vivid than normal. Flashing lights. Some people with optic neuritis report seeing flashing or flickering lights. When to see a doctor. Eye conditions can be serious. Some can be permanent, lead to permanent vision loss, and some are associated with serious medical problems. Contact your doctor if you develop new symptoms such as eye pain or a change in your vision. Symptoms worsen or don't improve with treatment. You have unusual symptoms like numbness or weakness in more than one of your limbs. It may be indication of a neurological disorder. I think I know the indications after 20 years. Let's see. Causes. The exact cause of optic neuritis is unknown. However, optic neuritis. Wait a minute. I just skipped the part. Boy, I love it. Messed up. Just as usual. Hold on. Risk factors for optic neuritis used from autoimmune disorders include age, optic fibers. Wait a minute, that's not far enough back. The exact cause of optic neuritis is unknown. However, optic neuritis is believed to develop when the immune system mistakenly targets a substance covering the optic nerve, myelin, resulting from inflammation and damage. Normally, myelin helps electrical impulses travel quickly from the eye to the brain. When they're converted to visual information, optic neuritis disrupts this process, affecting vision. The following autoimmune disorders are associated with optic neuritis. We'll just read the one I got. Multiple sclerosis, a disease in which your autoimmune system attacks a myelin sheath covering nerve fibers in your brain and spinal cord. In people with optic neuritis, the risk of developing multiple sclerosis following one episode is about 50%. Your risk of developing multiple sclerosis after optic neuritis increases further if an MRI scan shows lesions on your brain. It does. It does. Risk factors. Risk factors for optic neuritis arising from autoimmune disorder include age, most adults ages 20 to 40. Sex. Women have much more likely to develop optic neuritis than men by 3-to-1 ratio. Race. In the United States, optic neuritis occurs more frequently in whites than it does blacks. Genetic mutations might increase your risk of developing optic neuritis and multiple sclerosis. Complications. Yeah, I really love this complications. Optic nerve damage. Check. Already got it. Most people have some permanent optic nerve damage following an episode of optic neuritis, but the damage might not cause symptoms. Oh, yeah, it causes symptoms. Decreased visual acuity. Most people regain normal vision after several months. have a partial loss of eye color discrimination may persist. For some people, vision loss may persist after optic neuritis has improved. Steroid medications used to treat optic neuritis subdue the immune system, which causes your body to become more susceptible to infections. Long-term use of steroids may also cause other conditions, such as thinning of your bones. Test and diagnosis. Routine eye exam. Ophthalmoscopy. Pupillary light reaction test. Flunked. Visual evoked response. Flunked. MRI. Flunked. Blood test. Available to check for antibodies for neuromyelitis optica. People with severe optic neuritis may undergo this test to determine whether they're likely to develop neuromyelitis optica. Prognosis. Most people regain normal vision within 12 months after an optic neuritis episode. A long way to go. People with multiple sclerosis or neuromyelitis optica might have a greater risk of recurrent attacks. Oh, really? Since this is like the 10th one in 20 years, optic neuritis can recur in people without underlying conditions, but those generally have better long-term prognosis for their vision than do people with multiple sclerosis or neuromyelitis optica. Tell me about it. Okay. That's enough of that crap. I gotta live with it. You don't. Stars are almost like us. YouTube celebrities act like they're your friends, but does that change the nature of fame? Blondie, 29-year-old, naturally effervescent Grace Helbig, seems as though she belongs on television. Years ago, Helbig gave traditional star of a tribe performing in People's Improv Theater in New York City. But along the way, she began to make amusing confessional web videos with a friend, and clips posted online soon became much more. I quickly learned that hustling 100 people into a theater on Wednesday was way harder than trying to get 100 people to watch a YouTube video. Before long, she signed a 5-year contract with My Damn Channel, a multi-channel network, akin to a digital version of media conglomerates such as Fox. It was a decision that proved prescient. Between 2008 and 2015, her YouTube video channel gained more than 2 million subscribers. She broke away to launch an independent channel last year and since attracted more than 70 million views. And her roundabout trajectory to fame has cemented with the Grace Helbig Project, a comedy talk show that premiered on E! This April. As YouTube celebrates its 10th anniversary this month, Helbig and the rising class of celebrities on the site are grasping more fame than ever before. Like other famous YouTubers, Helbig found her niche and used her charisma and authenticity to attract legions of fans. And though YouTube celebrities are known among the internet natives than among their forebears, they now boast a surprising measure of real-world star power, as well as astronomical earnings and leverage with marketers looking to access elusive youth demographics. In other words, our media landscape features across more and more screens that are becoming the surest bets mature media brands have of discovering the next Chelsea Handler or Brad Pitt. But can YouTubers ever really become truly famous, or will they be forever relegated to beastless status? Hold on. We kind of created Justin Bieber, so we can absolutely, says Kevin Alaka, YouTube's head of culture and trends with a laugh, Alaka, and Helbig emphasized that much of the appeal of the celebrities weaned on social media lies in the promise of personal interaction. YouTube isn't an art gallery where we put up paintings for people to look at. We're there alongside you having a conversation. The immediacy provided by platforms like YouTube means that authenticity is incredibly important, more important than other types of talent we traditionally associate with stars. To be authentic is a real talent, one that successful YouTubers hold, such as Helbig, have in spades. Both Helbig and Ryan Higa, another famous YouTuber, says fans on the street stop them constantly. Okay, I'm having trouble. Higa, for his part, denies celebrity status. I don't consider myself a big star. My fans know my videos, but I'm sure their parents have never heard of me. The very nature of YouTube makes achieving cross-generational stardom fame difficult. Hold on a second. It says, Helga boasts 13 million subscribers, a remarkable number, but one that pales in comparison with the number of people who will see ads for Brad Pitt's movie. Moving from YouTube depth of fan interaction to the breadth of exposure demanded by mainstream media is difficult. Whether YouTubers should want or need to do so is another question. A creator with just 1 million subscribers earns a very comfortable living. Can't get the darn page turned. I'm having a few problems. Big problems. Little problems. Any problem. What isn't in question is YouTube's unprecedented growth. Venture capitalist Fred Wilson called 2014 the year of the platform. The year the platform became a monster. Online video consumption is up 9 times since 2010. Americans 12 to 24 watch 15% fewer films in theaters than they did in 2013. And Variety survey found that 6 out of 10 of the most popular celebrities among Americans 13 to 15 were YouTubers. Beating out such stars as Seth Rogen and Katy Perry. In response, Hollywood has made huge bets on the multi-channel networks. Disney has paid $500 million to purchase Maker Studios, and DreamWorks spent $33 million for awareness for Awesomeness TV, while Warner Brothers invested $18 million in Machina Nima. Even traditional talent agencies such as CAA, UTA, WME have begun directly signing YouTube's biggest names to weighty management contracts. Welch, however, cannot guarantee staying power. In a world where 2 days of video gets uploaded every minute, only that which is truly unique and unexpected can stand out. Things have only become more frenzied since YouTube stars must remain constantly, consistently remarkable. Given the YouTube dynamic, where transient oddities are delivered daily with little barrier to entry, the factor between success and obscurity is where presence is noted as suddenly as it's forgotten. No, it doesn't seem like YouTube stars of today are the enriching, enduring stars of tomorrow. The greatest barrier between YouTube celebrity and mainstream fame may turn out to be structural. Traditional celebrities is aspirational. People want to be George Clooney on YouTube. They just want to be friends with Grace Helbig. While talk show worst for Helbig became, if it's an extension of her YouTube personality. The appeal doesn't translate to a movie, or which you can play entirely different characters. Perhaps the biggest question over knowing over the rise of YouTube generation is whether celebrity itself is changing with them. Jennifer Lawrence wrote a story from a large part, in large part because we want to be her best friend. The same argument could be made about Channing Tatum, who is nothing if not kind, not the kind of guy who'd be fun at a bar. To borrow a YouTube colloquialism, Lawrence, in her authentic self, we feel as if we're friends even though we're not. For Helbig, at least, authenticity is in the engine behind her growing empire. Authenticity alone isn't enough to make you face or any other YouTuber. Make her or any other YouTuber the next Lawrence. Only the next 10 years of digital people will tell. Let's see. Hold on a second. Gotta get me a drink of water. Mouth's dry. Real dry. I'm gonna read one more article. Just a couple of pages. Hope I make it through it. Not really doing too good on it right now. If you could tell me, stumbling around. Tolerating the intolerant religious fanatics asked state legislators to legalize their bigotry. Many of us have had landlords from hell, but Ken Phillips and Gail Randall had a landlord from heaven. In 1987, they found their dream apartment in Chico, California, but there was one problem. Landlord Evelyn Smith was a devout Christian, and Phillips and Randall were unmarried. Smith turned them down. Cohabitation translated into extramarital sex, she reasoned. And facilitating such sinful behavior would hinder her chances of seeing the pearly gates. A 9-year court battle followed. Smith cited the 1993 Religious Freedom Restoration Act, saying it would substantially burden her free exercise of religion to aid and abet premarital sex. But the California Supreme Court disagreed, and landlords can check your credit rating, get ruled, but not your marital status. And the court told Smith she could find a new job. The Supreme Court says that worship isn't a license to break whatever law you'd like, but law and logic are no match for zealotry. This year, some 9 states are set to hear religious freedom restoration acts. Many of them mimic or go way beyond the language of the federal statute, Smith cited. Emboldened by Supreme Court's Hobby Lobby ruling allowing companies to refuse insurance coverage for birth control, the bill aims to open new loopholes for discrimination by giving businesses the right to refuse service on the basis of religious belief. 19 states have similar measures in place, but these bills will push the envelope. Texas aims to change the existing statute's language from prohibiting a substantial burden on the free exercise of religion to prohibiting any burden and make it state constitutional amendment, while Utah would go so far as to give worshipers grounds to sue others for impeding their beliefs. Hey, folks, this is getting a little ridiculous. What's new about this old bad idea is how it's being sold. That some people or groups don't deserve to walk in certain stores or restaurants isn't a hill anyone's eager to die for, but proponents of the new RFRAs are trumpeting them in the cause of the very language of civil rights or arguing for, of all things, tolerance. I filed SJR-10 to promote religious tolerance and protect the cherished and long-established right to religious freedom, Texas State Senator Donna Campbell wrote in her support of the bill. Campbell's words echo the Mississippi State Senator Philip Gandhi's. Grass to be a tolerant of many things, he said, and it states RFRA. And all we're asking for is some understanding and tolerance to our beliefs as well. Yet these senators are actually asking us to tolerate intolerance. It's a classic philosophical paradox. Must we tolerate intolerable beliefs in a tolerant society? Tolerance is less a position based on beliefs and more of a tug of war between acceptance and rejection. After all, we don't tolerate what we accept. We simply accept it. We tolerate only what we disapprove of. We don't tolerate Make-A-Wish Foundation, for instance. We tolerate the Westboro Baptist Church, because we can accept the principles of free speech while rejecting a particular nasty group. When Bill Robertson and his biblically bearded star of A&E's Doug Dynasty trotted out a cherry-picked line from the Old Testament in 2013 to say gay people are destined for hell, he was well within his rights to do so. The trouble, however, starts at the moment his beliefs become actions. In 1879, Mormons challenged the anti-polygamy laws. The Supreme Court quoted Thomas Jefferson on the difference between two. Congress can't legislate what you believe, the Founding Fathers said, but it can legislate how you act and especially how you treat others. If not, true believers such as those at Ponchatoula, Louisiana's Hosanna Church, the satanic inspiration for HBO's True Blood, a true detective, could use God to justify child abuse and sacrifice. We cannot engage in any conduct just because it has a religious reason, explains Jenny Pizer, senior counselor for Lambda Legal. Intolerant action is where the line must be drawn. The philosophical philosopher John Rawls believed that we must tolerate the intolerant, that we shouldn't suppress anyone's free speech, especially not when bound by our Constitution. And the exception when tolerating the intolerant hangs, our safety hangs in the balance. Justice, Rawls wrote, does not require much that men stand idly by while others destroy on the basis of their existence. When must we oppose religious intolerance? For Rawls, the answer is obviously. There must be an immediate danger in the equal liberties of others. And that's the problem with the new rash of RFRAs. These laws give business owners license to refuse service in places of public accommodation. The courts recently ruled against this type of discrimination in 2013. New Mexico Supreme Court ruled that photography studio violated anti-discrimination laws by refusing to photograph the commitment ceremony of two women. Then in December, Colorado Judge Robert Spencer ruled that a baker discriminated against two men by refusing to sell them a wedding cake. The First Amendment guarantees our right to refuse to engage in expression that conflicts with our religion, and the Supreme Court has ruled we can't force such unwanted expression, say in the case of West Virginia, that a school can't force a child to salute the flag. The baker and the photographer are a different problem, because if the student refuses to say the pledge on religious grounds, the kid's personal right does not collide with anyone else. In constitutional form of government, New Mexico Justice wrote in his ruling, personal religious and immoral beliefs which are acted upon or in detriment to someone else's rights have constitutional limits. While we may disagree with those who refuse to salute the flag, tolerating them brings no harm. This isn't the case with the baker or the photographer, or a restaurant owner who refuses black patrons, or a landlord who turns down unmarried couples, or politicians who propose bills that aim to restore religion, but to restore a way of life that we as a nation decided was reprehensible in the civil rights era. We defend religious believers, said Eunice Hyon Minreo, Advocacy and Policy Counsel for ACLU. But we never agreed with the principle that religion can be used to harm somebody else. religious freedom bills ask us to tolerate some so they can be legally intolerant of others. We can tolerate all sorts of disagreeable beliefs, but we don't have to tolerate any type of bad behavior, even in the name of religion. And that's why the fight over the RFRAs is really about. Well, AOI says that's good enough for today, so we'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Hope I helped you understand what I'm going through a little bit better. Have a great night, great day, wherever you are. See you next time. Bye.